and the inconvenience of other people.
Say hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Are we glad that we're not at the Glade stage? Thank you, Greenbelt.
We're going to talk with you about salvation, the inconvenience of other people. And what we thought we'd start is to talk about strangers and how annoying it is to think that you're a welcoming church and then realize that you actually have to welcome strangers in. Nadi is the pastor and founder of the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado. And I work at St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church in San Francisco. We have a long relationship of calling each other up to complain about other people.
Well, sometimes they're text messages, in all fairness.
Sometimes they're text messages. But so we thought we'd just talk for that for a little bit and then really invite your questions and your thoughts and your experiences about welcoming other people and to ask us, how the hell do you go about doing this? I thought I would begin, oddly enough, with a prayer. This is a prayer that is the very first thing that we say in our services, and it goes like this. Blessed be God, the Word, who came to his own, and his own received him not. For in this way God glorifies the stranger. O God, show us your image in all we meet today, that we may welcome them and you. Amen. Amen. So, and I just want to say quickly that we've been very deliberate about talking in our principles of how to run a church about glorifying strangers rather than welcoming strangers. Welcome, I think, is what nice church people do, which is that we assume this is our house, and because we're such nice people, we will welcome you poor, benighted outsiders in to our house as long as you do things our way. Glorifying strangers, on the other hand, suggests what I believe is the truth, which is that we need strangers. We need strangers for our own salvation. We need strangers to come in and disturb the peace. We need strangers to make us new. Because sadly, you may have noticed this, you really cannot be a Christian by yourself.
It's the worst part of Christianity, is that you cannot be a Christian by yourself. So I was reflecting on this and just thinking about that story of the Good Samaritan, and I feel like I was raised with that story, and really there's always, one of the best ways to kill scripture is to say, what's the moral of the story? And yet, that's how we so often read the text. So I think a lot of times with the parable of the Good Samaritan, by the way, if you've ever traveled to the Holy Land, you could pay someone to take you to the place where the Good Samaritan helped the injured man, which is funny because it's a parable. But feel free to donate your money to the locals and thusly. So I was taught that it's about the fact that we should be really nice and that we should be like the Good Samaritan. The moral of the story is that if somebody is needing you and is hurt and you can help them, that you should help them. This is the moral of the story of the Good Samaritan. But I think ultimately another way of thinking about it is that the Good Samaritan is about the fact that the person who is least likely in your life is the person who might save you. That you're, what, why don't we read it from the perspective of you're the man who was just beat up and along the side of the road? And what does it feel like to have somebody who's the least likely person in the world be the one to meet your need? So when we talk about welcoming the stranger, sometimes it's about the fact that they're the one who might save you.
So we were going to give you a couple of examples to get directly to the point, which is inconvenience, about how it looks when strangers actually do come in. Do you want to talk about
Yeah, okay, so I know a few people have read this story in my book, but I'm going to go ahead and tell it again because it's my story, and I can tell it as many times as I want to. Actually, someone asked me recently, they said, well, what's your next book about? I'm like, oh, yeah, it's another series of my own personal humiliations for the general public's enrichment, like my last book, so enjoy that. So we had often said that that we were a church that welcomed the stranger, like we'd used that language before. But what happened was I ended up invited to preach at Red Rocks, which is this natural amphitheater outside Denver, and there's a citywide Easter morning sunrise service. And then the Denver Post, our local newspaper, found out that I was preaching, and they thought, well, why is this weird tattooed lady who has a congregation of like 40 people preaching to 10,000 people on Easter Sunday morning? And so they ran a full front page story, including this huge picture of me in a short sleeve clergy shirt with my arms folded, looking over my glasses like I might kick your ass if you don't listen to my sermon. I have no idea why anybody came to my church after that, because I looked terrifying. But so what happened was, I preached in front of all these people, and then the paper ran this story, and we had a lot of visitors. But the thing is that, like, my congregation doesn't really read the paper. I mean, when that story came out, we were texting each other going, hey, where do you buy a paper? Like 7-Eleven or Tesco? Like, we didn't even know where to buy a paper. We are not people who read the paper. We get all of our information online. And so, but the thing is that, you know who does read the paper? 58-year-olds who live in the suburbs. That they read the paper. And you know who showed up the next week at our groovy urban church that's almost all young adults? 58-year-olds who read the paper and live in the suburbs. And so some churches might freak out if, like, the drag queens started showing up. We love them. But when it was, like, bankers in Dockers, like, wearing khaki pants and really straight-laced, and they're, like, kind of our parents' age, and they have respectable jobs, when they showed up to our church, we're like, what the hell? Like, we didn't know what to do. And I thought, man, they're messing up our weird. Like, and I call my friend Russell, and Russell's the pastor. He's a brilliant preacher and theologian, Russell Rathbun from House of Mercy in St. Paul, Minnesota, and they had a similar demographic to House. And so I call him up, and I'm like, dude, if, like, normal people ever, like, ruined your church? And fully expecting him to be like, yeah, here's what you do, you know? And he listened to me for a moment, and he goes, yeah, you guys are really good at welcoming the stranger if it's a young transgender person, but sometimes the stranger looks like your mom and dad. I was like, you're supposed to be my friend. Click. Like, how dare you preach the gospel to me at a time like this? And so... I had already called a meeting at this point to get people together, to have the people who had been around from the beginning to tell the story, because we need to have a meeting because we had this huge demographic change and church growth right away. And so the meeting, I thought, was going to be about the people who had been around from the beginning telling about who they are and why the church was around. So the people who just showed up would hear that and maybe self-select out, like kind of go, oh, yeah, this isn't actually... this probably isn't for us, you know. That's where my heart was. And I think in the chapter, I think I said, the point is like, it's really hard to be a pastor when you're not really that good of a Christian. So we have the meeting, but at that time, I had what I explain is like this sort of heart transplant where God reaches into my, and pulls out, rips out my heart of stone and replaces it with something warm and beating again. So by that time, I knew that what the meeting was really about was to have the people who were new show up, tell us who they were and why they were there, so that the people who'd been there from the beginning can hear what our church is about. And I told the story on myself about what Russell had said about sometimes the stranger looks like your mom and dad. And Asher speaks up, and he said, look, as the young transgender person who's been welcomed into this church... he said, I just want to go on record as saying I'm really grateful that there are people who look like my mom and dad in this church because they love me in a way that my mom and dad can't, and I'm really grateful for that. And I was like, Ooh, and meeting over. We can just close up now. So that was my experience about, like, and I think that's an important story in the fact that, like, I think people can look at our church and go, wow, you have these weird people who normally wouldn't be in church. So obviously you guys are about welcoming the stranger. But for us, what was hard was to, we have the exact same sin that every other church has, the exact same one. It just was with a different group of people. And so now you come in on a Sunday, and no kidding, there's like a statewide elected official who works at a Fortune 500 company next to an ex-convict, next to a soccer mom from the suburbs, next to a baby boomer who's a banker, next to a gay couple. And you're like, I'm unclear what all these people have in common. And I thought my church would be less weird if they showed up. And like now, because nobody matches, it's much weirder.
Well, St. Gregory's Church, of course, is entirely without the sin. We're really good at welcoming strangers, and in fact, welcoming strangers and glorifying strangers is kind of built into the core principles of the church. You're all invited, by the way, if you ever come to San Francisco. Please do drop in. Everybody does.
Yeah, everybody does.
It's a church that frequently, especially during the summer months, has more visitors that it does regular ongoing members. So we've become really good at looking people in the eye when they walk in for the first time, talking to them, sitting them down, going through things with them, asking them questions about themselves, being welcoming, trying not to be too creepy and friendly, just creepy and friendly enough. And we do this really well to the point of what you might call pride, that we're so good at welcoming strangers. We even have figured out our own technologies. If you come for the first time, and we ask you to make a name tag in red, and then you can be spotted later so we know you're a newcomer and go over and chat with you. Like a lot of churches in the United States, St. Gregory's had a couple of services in the morning. It had all kinds of Sunday school classes. But the Sunday school classes for everybody under the age of 18 happened during the main service, right? So the children were basically excluded from the service, though we let them back in for communion. Well, a couple of things started to happen. One was we take communion standing up in a big mob right around the altar in the center of the church. Everybody presses up close to the table. And while the priest chants the Eucharistic prayer. And one day, the priest, Paul Fromberg, was standing there with his hands raised up in the Orans position and chanting the prayer, and all the people were gathered around the table, pressed up really close against it and droning and humming along with him. And this young girl, Trinity, really her name, walked up and squashed herself in between Paul, who's a very large man, one of the few human beings larger and taller than Nadia,
it's true.
And the edge of the table, and put her hands in the Orans position and began to mouth the words of the Eucharistic prayer, to which she had been clearly paying attention for all those years when we thought, why are we letting the kids in for communion? It's really above them. They don't understand what's going on. So that was one breakthrough that, in fact, when the children were in church, they were paying attention to something. As another girl, Alexandra, said to us, well, I didn't really listen to the sermon, but the words kind of sneaked into my head. So we had a long series of meetings, and the church decided that we were going to make a commitment that children were going to be at the center of our worship. And I want to say emphatically by that, we did not mean that at a certain point in the service, the children would all come forward to be put on display while somebody talked, baby talked to them about Jesus, and then they would be sent out.
Yeah.
We don't believe in that.
Yeah.
We think of it as ritual humiliation of the children, and we don't like it at all. But that all our services would be for all of the people, whatever their ages were. It didn't go over so well. People really hated it. People hated it for many reasons. The children hated it because until that point, they'd been able to just run around and do whatever they want, and now they were having to go to church. The parents hated it because they felt personally shamed if their children made noise or disturbed things, or as they said, I just want 10 damn minutes to myself where I don't have to look after my kids all week. Is that too much to ask? And a lot of the people who didn't have children were like, well, they're going to be annoying, and they're going to be inconvenient, and they're going to be in the way, and they don't know how to sing, and they don't know how to read, and they're embarrassing, and they're weak, and they're silly, and they're, huh, that kind of sounds like how humans are before God. We don't have the slightest clue how to do things. We make these strange noises in God's direction. We're weak. We can't do anything by ourselves. So we persisted, and I'd like to tell you that it was a simple thing to do. But once we got to the basic principle that if your worship, to be successful, your worship depends on excluding somebody else, then it probably isn't Christian worship, right? And just as Nadia was talking about how important it is for some people to have strangers who look like your mom and dad, it turned out that there were a number of older adults for whom having children in the assembly was hugely healing. Gay people who'd never had kids, parents whose kids had gone, grandparents whose children were no longer near them, were able to be with the kids. And what it meant was that caring for children stopped being simply the job of the parents in this odd, privatized way, but became part of the entire assembly. And then the children started changing things because, just like Trinity, they wanted to be part of the service. So at this point, we now have a cantor who's 11 years old. We have, half a dozen kids who are Eucharistic ministers and who break the bread and share the wine and pass it around. We have kids reading the scriptures. And what has allowed us to do by glorifying the presence of kids is not to have a children's service per se, but to see something about what the breadth of the people of God is and to be made new by seeing that in ourselves as we go along.
Don't you have a special liturgical position for young boys, the, like, fire bearers?
Oh, yeah, we do. We have the minister of fire.
The minister of fire every week.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, you know, I understood that the real way to evangelize anybody under the age of 13 was to take them into the kitchen and let them play with fire and sharp knives.
I do have a postscript about my story, and that is that those middle-aged people who came to the church and messed up our weird are now like central, essential, beloved members of our community. And I cannot imagine us being us without them. First of all, they do shit, right? I mean, they just, like, sign up for jobs, and they always bring food. They're super responsible. So, like, in a way, our church functions for the first time because now we have middle-aged people there. But they're beloved. And then I found out a story about a year ago that one of those couples that are in their early 60s, they have an adult daughter who's chosen to no longer be in their life. They don't even know where she lives. They've been estranged for 5 or 6 years. So what they also get is they get young adults in their life who want them around, right? Who love them. And so that's kind of a beautiful piece of that story as well. So.
Right, and I think, you know, both of these stories are really to say that one of the things that's so fearsome about strangers is not that they're so different, but because they remind us of the things of ourselves that we find frightening or strange. We're going to have a little talk about technology and tactics.
Just first I want to just talk about hospitality, because I think a lot of churches talk about they really want to be a place that practices hospitality, or of course that lovely phrase, radical hospitality, whatever that means. I think hospitality is just hospitality. But I feel like I kind of stumbled upon this truth that I found difficult to stomach, and that is that You know you're practicing hospitality if you're uncomfortable in some way. Otherwise, really, you're just having your friends over.
Right,
yeah.
And I think what it does go back to, hospitality, and this is why we practice communion for everyone who walks in the door, is because, in fact, we're not really the hosts.
Yeah.
It's not really our table.
Yeah.
It's Jesus' table.
So we're going to talk about just some different ways that we practice this that are totally different.
Right.
Right? I mean, they're very different. The point is that both of our communities have thought through each of these things and struggled and adjusted and sort of come along a way of doing it that makes sense to us, but they ended up being very different. And so, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say, so I'm a midlife convert. I'd never been to church before. I took my first communion. So two things about that. One was the first time I went to church, I was offered communion. So that was quite an experience of being on the receiving end of hospitality. And I kind of thought that was how church worked. And then I went to a couple of different churches, and I suddenly felt humiliated, stupid, clumsy, and clueless, as if I had suddenly been dropped down, I don't know, in the middle of Bulgaria. It was like, why are these people standing up? Why are they sitting down now? What's that weird number that's posted up there? What's that book? What's that book? What's that book? What are they doing now? Why are they whispering? Why is everybody on their knees? Because I had no idea of what the conventions are. So when we design our liturgy, which we do in insane OCD detail, when we design our liturgy, we say that the point of the liturgy is that it is for the person who's there for the first time, who doesn't know what you're supposed to do, who doesn't know how you're supposed to behave in church. And so we do not use a church bulletin. We have a music book. We don't use instruments either, by the way, so everybody just sings. We have a music book with printed music that people can read, and we have a cantor who lines out the first line and sings it so that if you can't read music, you can follow it. We have the choir sit among the people so that you can always be guided by a voice. And most importantly, we have liturgical ministers of all ages who simply say, let's stand now and we'll sing number 51, My Soul Proclaims Your Greatness, O My God. Please stand and we'll sing number 51. So we tell you every step of the way what you're going to do. One, we don't privilege people who know how to read. And two, instead of having this privatized experience where you're sort of fumbling through a booklet, you're being told in the moment what's happening so that you can actually have the entire experience. We're not asking you to read along. We're putting everybody on the same level and telling you what's going to happen as the liturgy unfolds. We don't print the scriptures. You just pay attention to them. We don't print the order of service because everybody's being told what to do every step of the way. And the interesting thing for us is that newcomers always will say, because we debrief it and say, what was it like? What did you see? What did you notice to newcomers and among ourselves? And they say, oh, I knew what to do every step of the way. I never felt like an outsider because everybody was being told what was going to happen next.
I had a similar experience. Even though I was raised in a really fundamentalist tradition, I left the church for 10 years. And the first time I went to a Lutheran church, to a liturgical church, I had a very similar experience that Sarah did, where there was, okay, they gave me the order of service, and then there was an insert that had the readings and one of the prayers. And then, but on the order of service, it would have some word I'd never heard of, and then some kind of code. So it would say like Kyrie ELW42, and then it would be like Sanctus LBW69, right? So not only did you have to somehow know what the word, these weird words were, but you also had to know what the code was because no one would explain it to you. And there were two different colored hymnals in front of me. So I'm smart enough to realize ELW, and I looked at the title, oh, Evangelical Lutheran Worship, right? So but now we're like a third of the way through through the liturgy, and all I've been doing is trying to break the frickin' code in the order of service. And so it was like somebody was standing next to me the whole time going, you don't belong here. That's like literally what the experience felt like to me. So one of the things that we do have in common, the two congregations, is we have unapologetically open tables, and we're very explicit about it. So we literally have an announcement at the beginning that says this: we have an open table at House for All. What that means is that everybody, without exception, is invited during communion to come forward and receive bread and wine, which for us is the body and blood of Christ. If you choose not to commune for your own reasons, we invite you to come forward with your arms crossed and you can receive a blessing. So it's very clear, we're very emphatic, without exception. So when I go to a church and it says, all baptized believers, all Christians, any member of another church, any way in which you put a caveat around that, where you put a qualifier around that, you don't have an open table any longer. And in the Lutheran church, some people agree with this policy and some people don't. Some people feel like you should have to be baptized. And if you're a convert, you're baptized, you want to seek out the table, and so you'll seek out baptism. But we've literally had people who were fed so much grace at that table that they sought out the font. So I don't know that we have the right to order the sacraments in a particular way. I think the Spirit does work in people that we don't really get to dictate.
As I like to say,
I'm one of those people that Nadia talks about who took communion and then chose baptism. And what that taught me is that grace is not sequential.
Right, that's right, yeah. So at House, our liturgical practice is different. We do have the booklet, but if you were in my session on Friday, I talked about this. We have every single thing in the bulletin, so you don't have to juggle this insert and then this order of service and then two different hymnals. So everything is lined out and explained, and there's instructions in there, and some instructions are given verbally. And so it's important to us that people know, hey, you know, all of this is for you, all this participation's for you. The way we do the liturgical jobs in our church is that we have a table set out. We call it the table of contents when you come in, and all of the booklets for worship are in a basket, but then there's 15 or 18 of them that are lined out on the table. And those at the top will say call to worship, confession, the collect, the first reading, the gospel reading, post-communion prayer, assisting minister at communion, benediction, all of that, communion server, right? And so people come in, and the very first time you walk into the church, it does not matter what your background is, what your belief system is, what if you even know what you're doing, you will be asked, would you like to lead one of the parts of the liturgy? So we've had people, first-time visitors. The best is when a first-time visitor gets the announcements, because the first announcement is always, welcome to House for All Sinners and Saints, and welcome especially to our visitors. And it's like a visitor doing it. But what happens is that when you let go of what I say, if you let go of predictability and control by putting it out there to say, like, we actually trust you. You walk into this church, we're going to trust you with the holy things right away. You don't have to prove yourself. You don't have to go to frickin' training. You don't have to be on somebody's list. You don't have to be on Agnes's list, you know? And Agnes gets to decide if you do it because she puts together the rota. None of that, right? You're worthy to do this in God's eyes and in our eyes. The worthiness for everyone here is exactly the same. So what you get, and I told this story on Friday, is that we had this very large transgender woman come. She doesn't look transitioned. She does look sort of like a large man with a dress on, which some churches might really have a hard time with that. But for us, she walked in and we're like, do you want to do a job? She's like, well, I like reading. And so she took the gospel reading, which during Lent is approximately that long. And because we're in the round, we like to be able to see each other. It facilitates a sort of accountability of presence that you guys are face each other as well. There's a quarter of the people who couldn't see where this person was reading from. And this very male voice actually comes out and does this gorgeous reading of the gospel. It was so gorgeous that it was like, it felt like I'd never even heard that text before. And, you know, a quarter of the people turn around to go, oh my gosh, that's beautiful. Who's reading that? And then they see this transgender person. So, like, we got to have this incredible experience of the gospel in this stranger glorified to the point of preaching the gospel to us. And we never would have had that opportunity if we had to decide who was worthy to do different jobs. Oh yeah, sometimes people are horrible at these jobs. That's the other part. Right. Like, no, like, seriously. Like, we stole that thing from Mark Pearson that we're anti-excellence, pro-participation. And that what that means is that giving away predictability and control is that sometimes the people who totally suck at the jobs are going to do the jobs. Right. And you have to, and especially as the pastor, you have to be able to let go of, this is not a reflection on me. Right? If something's done poorly in the liturgy, it's not a reflection on me. I have to let that go if that starts creeping up inside of me. And go, this is what it means to favor all voices being present over the best voices being present.
Right. And I think, as you can see, both of our churches are places that have really spent and continue to spend a lot of time trying to decide what the principles are that animate us, and really to work backwards from those principles and to be continually reevaluating them. If we just sort of work on the basis of what we like, right? Well, I like bluegrass music. Well, I don't. I like good old-fashioned hymns. Well, I don't like that. And then you're just sort of stuck in one place. If you've got principles like the things of God are for the people of God, that God calls all people to participate in God's saving work, that strangers are one way that the Spirit makes the church new continually, then you're able to work together to adapt liturgy, to make new liturgy, and to always remain open to the ways that we're being changed. So really, just to finish up with a couple of principles, and then to ask you to ask your own direct questions, give you a hint, Nadia and I like real questions rather than speeches. And also, we're both complete nerds, so the more technical liturgy questions Nadia and I will really geek out on.
Also, if you're an introvert, if you want to write a question down, we'd be happy to have those read out loud, too. So if you'd rather write one, that's fine. Yeah.
But I think, for me, the reason to glorify strangers again is based on this belief that our liturgy is a reflection on what we think God is doing in the world, and therefore what we are doing. We're not inviting everybody to participate in communion because we're nice people. Right. We're saying Jesus welcomes everybody to his table, and so we're going to offer the bread and wine to everybody. We believe that God is continually making all things new, that things which were cast down are being raised up, and things that had grown old are being made new, and all things are being brought to their perfection. But that making new only happens when the door is actually open to glorify the unexpected, the stranger who comes in and screws up our perfectly nice church.
Am I talking about the Great Commission? Yeah. I know I said this in another session, so feel free to chat with your neighbor if you've heard this already. But I've been reflecting a lot on the Great Commission, and the way I was raised, I was taught that the Great Commission, when Jesus says, "Go and forth to all nations, baptizing and making disciples, and baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit." I was taught that what that meant is that now we have this sort of the one sort of saving truth in the world, and it's given to you, and so you're responsible to give it to other people or else they'll be lost. So other people need you to save them with this message. And that's a perfectly fine reading, but I think an alternate reading of it, and in my experience, how I've experienced it, is that I think Jesus knew that that if we did not have people for whom the faith was brand new in our midst, we will immediately or very quickly forget what the faith is really about, and all of a sudden we'll be arguing about the color of the carpet in the sanctuary instead, right? So if you have somebody who's newly discovered the faith, who's come in a new way into the faith, and they actually understand what forgiveness of sins means and what it means to be made new and what it means to be felt to feel like you're experienced death and resurrection and to understand the actual power of the sacraments, if you have those people in your midst, You're less likely to lose the plot and become miserable bastards like so many other churches are, right? So, part of welcoming the stranger or evangelism is about is like, I'm desperate to remember what this thing really means, and I'm so much more likely to be clued into that if I'm around someone for whom it's new. Or I think the other important thing is we need new people coming into our communities, messing them up on a regular basis, or else we immediately start arguing about carpet color. So I think Jesus was quick to realize this. And then what did they do almost immediately? Ooh, they gathered together, like separate from everyone else, alone in an upper room for fear of others, right? So he was right. It happened quickly. What they needed was a stranger. What they got was the Holy Spirit. But what they needed was like strangers messing it up. And so the Holy Spirit came, busted open the doors, and then all the strangers, you know, the Edes, the Elamites, whoever the hell these people were, like all these people at Pentecost came and messed up their perfectly precious little church that they had with just them and Jesus.
Good. Let's pause while people come and take questions. You can come up here to the microphone.
Stand up? Can I stand up instead of sit? Sorry. This chair is like tiny.
I'll just crouch down here like a little mouse.
Oh, you're ready. Go for it, girl.
Sorry about that. I want to know what you'd suggest when the stranger who turns up wears a dog collar and decides that your particular expression of church community doesn't fit into their plan for the parish and swiftly disbands it. Not that I'm talking about spirits or anything.
Is that a thing? Like, that happens?
3 years ago.
And it sounds like it wasn't just you.
No.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if that's a stranger or an asshole.
I am so not going to reveal where I'm from.
Well, the thing is, I mean, if you're talking about welcoming the stranger, what that doesn't mean is that every single person and every single type of behavior and every single neuroses and issue someone has is just totally embraced in this totally codependent way by the church because we're the good guys. That's not what it means. I mean, there have been, and with it being a clergy person, I don't know, that's a sticky situation, but there have been people who have come into our parish who are like deeply unhealthy and are not actually seeking water, the living water. They're not seeking the living water, right? They aren't actually seeking new life or death and resurrection. What they're seeking is to suck the entire parish emotionally dry and not be better afterwards and go on to the next parish, right? And so I actually do patrol the perimeter of my church very fiercely like a mother bear. And so if somebody is being destructive, that's not allowed. So I draw boundaries with unhealthy, we have broken ass people. If you come to my church, they're broken people, right? But they're not like damaging each other, right? In a way where they're not even aware they're doing it because they're borderline personality disorder or something. So I draw boundaries quickly and kindly and consistently and clearly with people whose behavior I think is damaging to others. So it's not this like, oh, just come to us. We'll agree all your problems are of other people's making. Yeah, you know what I mean? That like Christian community is not about co-signing on each other's bullshit. That's not what it's about. So I don't want you guys to get the message, like, in order to be really good Christians, you just have to let all kinds of nonsense into your parish, you know? That's not...
So how do you do that then? Because, like, let's set the pastor thing to one side because that gets into bishops and complicated and I'm working on that with God, whatever. But for you, when you recognize somebody who's coming into your church with that sort of mindset, how do you, as a leader of that community...
We're Americans, so we're able to say things directly to people.
I've been really enjoying the swear words today, so thank you for that.
Thank you for what you've shared, and I'm a bit of a liturgy nerd as well, and really enjoyed what you had to say about your Sunday gathering. For those of us who are in Christian communities / churches, expressions of church, where perhaps the least important part of their church is what happens on a Sunday morning and what happens the other 6.9 days of the week. What does, for you guys, what does honouring and glorifying the stranger look like for the rest of the time outside of... That's not saying that what you've said about the Sunday gathering isn't important, because I found it really useful, really, really useful.
Let me talk to that, because... So I took communion at this beautiful altar in the middle of the church, and then a few things happened, and then I decided to be baptized. And the weekend that I was baptized, I also began a sort of free farmers market food pantry right in the middle of the sanctuary around the same altar. And the reason the liturgy mattered was because the food pantry was started not as a social service program, but as a direct outgrowth of that same liturgy, what the Orthodox call the liturgy after the liturgy. And it was done in the same principles, which was that we were going to offer food to everybody without exception, and we're going to offer everybody to participate in it. So now every week there are, 400 families who come to get food around the altar and who actually run it themselves, who run and share this giving away of food that really is modeled on the way that we welcome strangers in the liturgy. So we don't say, well, you can come and get food if you can prove that your income is X. You can come and get food if you don't have a home. You can come and get food if you are this kind of person or a member of the church. We just say, Jesus welcomes everybody to his table. So we're just going to keep doing this stuff not just on Sundays, but all the time. So it's a direct outgrowth of these same principles, because it turns out that the stuff we do in church on Sundays means something, right? And it's actually a guide to our entire lives inside and outside of church.
I totally agree with that, and I think, and we are primarily a word and sacrament community, and so, but what's interesting is there is extremely strong community in the church, and there's so much lay leadership, and I suspect that when people come in the door, and what they basically hear by our actions is, we trust you with the holy things, like you can come, we won't even know who you are, and you can be the assisting minister at the Eucharist next to the pastor. I think then they're trusted with their own leadership and other things as well. So much of what happens in the community comes from the lay people. I find out about it eventually, usually, but like there are all these groups and programs and stuff that the laity have started, because I think they feel empowered because they were trusted with holy things originally when they walked in the door on Sunday.
So are you, follow-on question. Are you finding then that people are watching what you do on a Sunday morning and going and doing likewise in their homes, in their social circles, in their life?
Yes.
That's the kind of spill-out you're seeing, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So and they're actually, they're not watching, they're participating.
Right. Okay. And so, for instance, there's a parishioner of mine, she was in this really evangelical church where she was told all the time what she should be like. All the time, right? This is what your personality should be like. This is what your, sex life should be like. Here's how your relationship with your mother should look. And she could never do that. Her mom's crazy and slightly abusive. And so she'd get reactive about her mom, and then she'd feel bad about being reactive because she really should be having a particular response because her church told her that, right? But now she's been at House for so many years where what she hears all the time is God is gracious and merciful and slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and God is present in your life, and nobody else gets to tell you who you are. Like she's heard this message for so many years that a few months ago her mom posted something crazy on Facebook, and then her mom said, this is going on, that's going on, but I just feel God's love and presence. And this parishioner of mine said, Nadia, it was amazing because normally I would have read that and gotten super triggered and reactive about my mom. She goes, but this time I read it and I thought, of course she feels God's love and presence because that's God's nature. She believed it so much, she heard it so much that she believed it for herself, that she even believed it for her mom. And none of that came through the church coercively telling her how to live or what, hey, if you're a good Christian and if this stuff matters, here's what it should look like in your life.
A tale of two churches. There's a sting in the tale, though. 10 months ago, I first attended Metropolitan Community Church, MCC, in North London. And the age range there is such that those of us who are slightly beyond 58 are in a distinct minority. Indeed, anybody over the age of 45, I think, is in a distinct minority. The second week I was there, I went up to somebody and I said, "Hey, I think you're new here," because in that first week I had been so affirmed and welcomed by that church. My second church, well, it's really my first church because I've been a member there for 42 years. And I suppose I got quite well known in that church and quite involved. And here's the question. 2 years ago, I came out. So in a sense, from being involved in the church, I am still involved in that church, I became a stranger. I'd like your thoughts on people within a church who become strangers.
You know, I think I don't quite know what you mean by you became a stranger, whether you mean that you were cast out of that church.
No, I wasn't, fortunately, but I do know churches where that does happen.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think Nadia would agree with me that as much as we would like to be able to control the way that everybody in our churches behaves, it's not always possible to do that. But I think that, again, the model of how we do liturgy, which is deeply affectionate, deeply respectful, and deeply real, where we're willing to talk with people actually about what's going on rather than leave them to guess about it, is really the only way that I know. It's not social engineering, but what it is a way of living in truth, which I think is at the heart of whatever kind of Christian community you want to be in, which is just as you can't really have Christian worship if it depends on excluding some people so that it's quiet and nice, you also really can't have Christian community if it depends on lies to sustain it.
Yeah, and to your first point about you welcoming someone the second week, I do see that at church a lot. In our leadership meeting, someone said that there were these three young women in the pew behind them the week before who they didn't recognize, who were going out of their way to welcome all the visitors that week. So I think it does begat itself, for sure. Yeah.
Hello. I was wondering, are your churches new communities, or have you come into existing communities and seen change? And particularly with the latter, with the idea of an existing church community that might have been established for a long time, what kind of things do you think can help with the change and the dynamic for people to steer towards what you're describing? What's crucial? What's workable? Are there baby steps? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I started the church I serve when I was still in seminary in 2007. We've been worshiping weekly since 2008. So yeah, it's a new church. Hers is super old. It's like, what, 30 years?
Oh, yeah, I think it's 30 years.
It's a very
years.
Old church in America.
And it's a 30-year-old church. I'm in the second generation of leadership after the founders. And when I started working there, people insisted that it had been much better in the old days.
That happens approximately 20 minutes after you start a church. They're right. Like, it was so much better 20 minutes ago. But to your point, I always try and say that I feel like experience has a lot of authority. So I try to stay in my experience. And I've not been in a traditional church and tried to steer it another direction. So ultimately, I have no authority to say anything, but I'll still say something. And that is that, I said this before, but that I think it's really important to, you know what the term reverse engineering is? It's like when the iPhone came out, Samsung had engineers reverse engineering it. So you have something that's existing in front of you that maybe you don't know how it works, right? So you have to break it down to its composite parts to figure out why it works. So I do suggest that any church can reverse engineer their own practices, right? Why do our bulletins look this way? Why do we always have this on the first Sunday? Like, sometimes there are reasons to do things, but like, you've long forgotten them. Now it's just become habit, and habit really is no reason to keep doing something. And so if you reverse engineer it, and I gave an example last time, I'll give another one, which is that if you have a music director who has a graduate degree, and forgive me if you're a music director or a musician, but if let's say they have a graduate degree in sacred music, and so the hymns for Sunday, like what's the value behind your practices is what you're trying to get to. Let's say all the hymns on Sunday, the reason that they're chosen is because this person has a graduate degree in sacred music and they want to preserve this tradition. And so you're singing really unsingable, obscure hymns, but are super matchy-matchy with the text on Sunday. And then there's notes about the composer. And so really the ultimate value is preserving high culture. Like, that really is the ultimate value in your community. There actually is nothing wrong with that. You need to say it out loud. Say it out loud. Do the work to be as honest as you can and take your practices and get them down to what the values are behind them. And then if you say them out loud, if enough people cringe, you might have a chance at changing it. But what doesn't work is to just change the practice without doing that difficult work of being honest about what the values are behind it first.
Right. And I think that's exactly right, and I think that the way that works is to do it not just when you run up against a block, but to do it every week, to talk every week about what happened in church, why did it happen, what does that show? Well, we did this, what does that say? Is that really what we mean? That's important. And I think the only other thing that I would add is, in my experience, nothing has ever changed because of a committee. The only way to begin to enter into this process of change, in my experience, is to sit down and eat with people and pray with them.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we don't have a committee. Neither of our churches have a committee structure, just to let you know. That's a pretty critical thing to know, too.
Slightly different angle. Young people in this country, I don't know whether it's true in America, the popular churches with young people and students tend to be the non-liturgical churches. What experience have you got of young people without a church background coming into a liturgical context catching it? Because I work in a diocese here in the UK as a missioner. I travel around and all our churches that are on a trajectory of decline are liturgical churches, and all of our so-called growing and so-called flourishing churches, and we could unpack that for hours, are lively, non-liturgical, high-voltage worship-type churches. So I'd love to hear from you your experiences of young people engaging in liturgical church.
I think most of the growth in our church in the last 3 years has been people in their 20s and 30s, a significant number of them from ex-evangelical backgrounds, and they are hungry for sacramental life. Mm-hmm. And we are, would you describe us as a very liturgical church?
Yes.
We're kind of
Byzantine, basically.
Yeah, we're kind of Byzantine. We're really, really traditional in a sort of fourth century way, not in an English way.
And same with us. We're very, very, very liturgical. It's very traditional, but not conventional, which I think is a really interesting distinction to start making. And so we have more traditional liturgy than most Lutheran churches do, who are trying to be relevant. And we have more than 50% young adults in our community, and a lot from evangelical backgrounds, a lot. We have more young adults from evangelical backgrounds than we do from liturgical backgrounds.
Well, and how many, we have almost no Episcopal people who are raised in Episcopal churches. You have a lot of Lutherans?
Yeah, we have like 300 people involved in the parish, probably 20 Lutherans, right? That's not the deal. So the thing is that, it's liturgy, but it's done so differently, so differently. First of all, we're in the round, so it's very participatory. We also do not have a band or an organ. We don't have the people who are good at playing the instruments, the professional musicians, providing most of the music in the liturgy. All of the music in the liturgy comes out of the bodies of the people who showed up, and they sing in a cappella four-part harmony. Again, same with them. We have a choral guild who learns all the parts with the cantor, and then they sit among the community to facilitate that singing. And then it's so participatory. You have so many different voices in the room. You don't have the two special people who are taking up a third of the physical space in the church, facing everyone who's like looking at the backs of each other's heads. You know, it's not like this. You know, it's not set up like this. So it's very participatory. Also, it's extremely, I don't know the right word for it, but like this is my liturgy leading voice. I don't have a different persona as a pastor. Like, I'm literally the same person in every situation you meet me in. And so nobody's coming and going, through Jesus Christ, our Lord, amen. You know what I mean? Like, there's no affectation. It's very matter of fact. So when I welcome people, I welcome them with my personality in my body and with my voice. And it helps them relax. They don't feel like they have to peek behind the curtain to see who's really there. So there's this matter-of-fact way that the liturgy's led that I feel like is inviting for people. The other piece is because of the way we do the prayers of the people, people write the prayers of the people that are then read out loud later in the liturgy after they hear the sermon, because we have a 10-minute time of prayer and reflection right after the sermon. And so you get to hear read out loud in our holy space what's actually weighing on people or what they're actually celebrating. And they aren't attached to individuals. You just get to hear it. So it's like, all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, someone had a miscarriage this week, you know? Or somebody had an aunt who was diagnosed with breast cancer. Or somebody got a job after 6 months unemployment. There's this truth. Because the thing is people are pretending their whole lives. That's how it's set up in society. You have to pretend that your marriage is better than it is. You have to pretend that you love everything about being a new mom. You have to pretend you're not smarter than your boss. Like, so much of your life... So much of your life is spent like pretending and putting something on. And it's like, oh my gosh, can church just be the 1 hour in the week where you just let that shit go? Where you can just like let it go and be broken or be joyful or be whatever you actually are. And instead, what so many churches are asking people is to be, it's one more place to pretend. Nobody needs that. Nobody needs one more place to pretend. So... So I'm not pretending, and the parish isn't pretending, and oh my God, you can feel that when you're there.
I think what I'm hearing is that for most of us in the UK, the traditional churches are so held up by an older generation of people who do it like you just described, that the best way forward to grow liturgical churches with young people is to replant and reshape, but only the liturgy.
Right, and I would make this, I would not say that it's a division necessarily between old people and young people, and I think that...
It comes to some of our churches. Yeah, no, some of our churches.
Right. But what I think is really important to do is to distinguish between tradition and nostalgia.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Like, tradition is beautiful. Tradition is a treasure in the field, right? Tradition is buried sometimes, and sometimes we've buried it under a mountain of crap of our own invention. But there's a tradition that is incredibly powerful. It is incredibly powerful for me to stand on the Salaya and sing the Shema with my people, right? Nostalgia, which is, wow, we used to have such a great praise band. Let's always have that beautiful praise band doing the same songs. That's nostalgia, right? So you have to be able to distinguish.
Hi, I have a question. You started to talk about your technology expertise and using name tags.
Oh, yeah.
My question is, are the name tags only for visitors, or does everyone...
Everybody has a name tag. It's just that we ask you, when you come, if you come the first time, write your name in red. If you're coming again, write it in black. And that doesn't mean that you don't talk to the people who are wearing blank name tags. It just means that you can't have church as a place where you just go and talk to your best friend and turn your back on the newcomer.
Hi there. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I love my tradition. I'm actually starting seminary in September. But in our tradition, we have quite a lot of rules. For example...
Really?
We have closed communion.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that's what God wants, you know, one day I might be leading a church. I want it to be as welcoming as possible. But... how can we get past these rules where you can actually get into a lot of trouble for breaking them?
Yeah, but you know what? Some Catholic parishes have a don't ask, don't tell policy. Well, and people know, right? They know, hey, you know what? You can actually go and take communion there because nobody will ask you. So they aren't technically breaking the rule.
You omit it from the service
paper.
But if you want to make that welcome, we're forbidden to.
Right. Yeah, well, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I don't know what to say, and I certainly would not presume to give advice to you. It was a Jesuit friend of mine who said to me rather bitterly, old men in Rome would ration the ocean if they could. but I think, again, the point of being welcoming is because... we need strangers. The point is not to try to be generous or nice or friendly or make everybody feel good. We can't make everybody feel good, but God feeds every living thing. Mm. And the more closely we can align ourselves with the mission of God, and the more closely any of us in our churches can talk honestly about what do we believe the mission of God actually is, as opposed to what do we think Article 1.9 of our bylaws say, I think that only leads to a conversation that's fruitful and generative.
Thank you for staying in your tradition, because if you have a desire for that open communion and you're staying in the Roman Catholic Church, that's really powerful. So you should come back and tell us what that ended up looking like. And I really just wanted to honor you for choosing to stay in that tradition. Yeah, I think that's it. Are we done? Sorry. So they told us we have to stop talking. So you've been sorry to the people in line. You've been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Let's hear it for Sarah and for Nadia. Thank you so much for sharing with us here.